Recognize Umbral Walker D01. Recognize the Caleb G D02.
Hello, team. Thanks for listening to Whelmed, the Young Justice Files, episode 13. Welcome to the cave. I am everyone's favorite sidekick, Caleb, and I've had practice juggling my multiple personalities. Allow me to introduce Rich Timber Howard.
Oh, Robin.
As always, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We absolutely and truly appreciate it from the bottom of our hearts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter at the YJ Files. You can email us directly, whelmedpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, visit our website, www.crashingthemode.com.
These cannot be coincidences. Unrelated criminals are cooperating with one another worldwide.
Exactly. It's now clear our enemies have formed some kind of secret society of supervillains.
And with that housekeeping out of the way, let's turn it over to Rich for...
Hello, Megan!
Title this week of our episode is Revelation. The release date was October 14th, 2011. The previous episode was just the week before, October 7th. The in-episode date is October 1st. The director was Michael Chang, and the writer was Kevin Hopps.
And I would like to point out that this episode does feature some really cool guest voice work.
Yeah.
Miss Alyssa Milano pops up. Our old friend Brent Spinner pops up. And Kevin Michael Richardson pops up. So we all know what role he has in Young Justice.
One of the most important.
And with that information out of the way, I think it's time to start our mission briefing.
Just in time for your next mission.
The pre-credit scene has a giant animated plant creature tearing through the Metropolis streets, attacking random passersby. We then cut to a secret base where we see a group of villains, few of which we've seen before, calling themselves the Injustice League, boasting about their new creation. And this team consists of Count Vertigo, the Atomic Skull, Poison Ivy, Wotan, Ultra Humanite, Black Adam, and finally, the Joker.
Back at the cave, the team is training when Batman arrives to show them national news of numerous plant creatures attacking Metropolis, as well as Gotham and other sites worldwide. Batman speculates that the plants are on a variant of the Cobra Venom. Because of the various connections made throughout the series so far, the team and Batman connect the dots that a secret society of supervillains is at work. Joker and the Injustice League cuts into communications, asking for $10 billion in U.S. bills. The team and the League now assume the Injustice League is the secret society. Zatara tracks Wotan's magic surge to the Louisiana Bayou, and Batman sends the team to disrupt the central control mechanism for the plants.
The League heads out to fight the plants, which are not only physically attacking cities, but they're also, we quickly find out, releasing Joker venom throughout the streets from exploding pods. The League does this while the team flies to Louisiana in camouflage mode in the bioship. Kid Flash asks Aqualad what he brought in a duffel bag, and Calder answers Plan B. Further questions are cut off because Count Vertigo sets the bioship and McGann off kilter with his dizzying powers, and the bioship crashes into the swamp, pulled under the water by Poison Ivy's giant plant pets.
The team escapes the sinking bioship only to be attacked by Count Vertigo, Black Adam, and the rest of the Injustice League. Robin and McGann disappear at Aqualad's command to fulfill the mission. We then get several cutscenes back and forth between the League fighting plants and the team fighting in the swamp.
The team is freed from the plants doing all kinds of craziness and distracts the Injustice League long enough for McGann and Robin to blow up the central control plant. Unfortunately, the team starts losing badly, especially when Wotan wakes back up again after having been knocked out by the bioship. That's when Calder initiates Plan B, putting on the Helmet of Fate, which he was carrying in the duffel bag. Kid Flash tries to stop him, knowing what the consequences will be. Kid Flash gets his arm broken. Fate slash Aqualad barely holds his own against Wotan, who we'll chat about in a little bit. Artemis manages to take down Vertigo, but the team is clearly outmatched, at least until the League arrives.
The final scene is the Light happy with both the plant creature's success and the fact that the Injustice League has taken the fall for their actions. But unlike previous episodes, the Light is no longer obscured by computer screens, and we get a full shot of the roster. We see Vandal Savage, Queen Bee, Ocean Master, Ra's al Ghul, Lex Luthor, Clarion the Witch Boy, and our old French favorite, the Brain.
There is a lot of stuff in this. Let's get some Master going.
Oh man, this episode is so packed full of goodness. Let's jump right into...
Superboy, are you alright?
I'm fine. Feeling the Aster.
Rich, take it away, sir.
I mentioned it real quickly, so I'll go ahead and dive into Wotan. As everybody knows, there's a lot of nods to the history of DC here. Wotan is a classic Dr. Fate villain, meaning Wotan can go toe-to-toe with Fate. So in this episode, Wotan says, "I have prepared for your return, Doctor." Well, here's the deal. We already know that Fate's been gone for like 50, 60 years. So that means Wotan is the near immortal that he is in the DC comics, which is interesting to me. And of course, goes toe-to-toe with this Aqualad, you know, Fate combo as well. And why Aqualad, it answers why Aqualad brought the helmet in the first place. They don't bring the helmet casually to fight scenes. But in that same thing, like, speaking of that, like, when Calder put that helmet on, I was like, oh, this isn't good. Like, Calder has way more affinity, physical strength, durability than Kid Flash. This is bad. Like, my definitely concern went up. Also, when the first time I watched it, I was like, wow, Calder's a new character. We don't know anything about his history from DC Comics or what happens to him. Does he turn into the new Dr. Fate? Like, I remember the very first time I watched this, like, I had no idea what was going to happen. If it had been Robin or that kind of thing, I would have been, you know, more reluctant to think, well, you know, they're going to just leave the helmet on him. But yeah, fantastic. And we'll talk about a little bit more of that in Crashing the Mode. And then there's so many nods besides Wotan. Black Adam, for those of you who don't know and couldn't tell by the outfit, Black Adam is a classic villain for Captain Marvel / Shazam and has all of his powers and abilities. So he's basically Superman is who they were fighting. And then on the hero side, you've got Guy Gardner makes an appearance, the third Green Lantern. I'm sorry. I love to hate Guy.
But I love that as he shows up, he's there and he's got that smarmy little nod and salute. If you know the character, you're immediately reminded of how much of a goofball he is. But he doesn't distract
and
from the episode. Yep, he's an absolute jerk.
Right.
And they updated his costume. You know,
I was going to say the same thing. I liked the new costume for him. Yeah. I liked what they did for that.
His old school goofy weird vest thing.
Yeah.
But it looks good now. It looks really good now.
Yeah.
We saw a bunch of other people. We saw Plastic Man. We saw Rocket and Icon. Yep. We saw Captain Atom.
This was our first Rocket and Icon sighting. And then in later episodes, they start mentioning their names, but we see them here. The one that cracks me up, though, is Blue Devil. Man, I was around when Blue Devil first got introduced. He's got the weirdest, not the weirdest, but he's got a pretty weird origin story. And he keeps showing, like, somebody that does Justice League and Justice League Unlimited and Young Justice, they have a soft spot in their heart for Blue Devil because he always shows up in the background. It's so funny to me.
Now, I did not know who he is.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
I had a specific note here while I was watching the show. Who's the guy with Flash, not Captain Atom?
Right. So I don't know what, like, maybe his retconned origins may be, but the character of Blue Devil, Here's one of our little mini secret origins, I guess. The human inside, who I can't even remember. Sorry, man. He was a stuntman, a movie stuntman. And they had developed this suit. It was a powered armored suit thing for him to do his stunts in, including the trident that has fires blasts and all this stuff. It was for a movie. And then something happened, and I can't remember what it was, but he got trapped inside the suit. And so then became a superhero. And at some point, I think pre-52, his comic was actually really good. I remember reading it and enjoying it. And at some point, it might have been on one of the, I don't know, some random crisis, or there's a big event in the history of DC Comics that involved basically Satan making deals with everyone. The suit became not a suit, and he actually became a mystic devil creature. So I'm not sure what his situation is now in the DC titles and the rebirth. I don't know if they even have him in the comics at all anymore. But that's such a bizarre, weird, like, history. It's so funny to me when he shows up. He never has a main part. He almost never speaks, but he's always in the background somewhere. I don't know if they're like, hey, we can easily get the rights to Blue Devil. Let's throw him in here, too. We need somebody else. I don't know. It's
hysterical. Well, it was definitely cool seeing a deep cut of the Justice League roster in there. A lot happened in this episode. There's a lot of action. We all know I like the big action scenes, and this episode did not disappoint. This was really the first big mission that the team was given. Batman says right off the rip, the League has to be seen fighting the plants. You guys need to go to Louisiana. Right. And he kind of leaves it hanging. And I love this because Wally doesn't get it. And Artemis just keeps punching him in the shoulder. Batman is telling these kids to take on supervillains.
Yeah, serious supervillains. Like Ultra-Humanite. I mean, they didn't give him much of a part here. But man, Ultra-Humanite is bad news. You compare him with Black Adam. I mean, the fact that they had Vertigo leading the team. Okay, I guess he's got the presence. He's a royalty. He's kind of got that leadership quality or whatever. He's clearly the minor league villain in this team. You back him up with Atomic Skull, which should be able to literally nuke everyone in this, but they kind of have him mostly powering the device that they're using, and of course Poison Ivy in a swamp. Bad combo.
Right, and you said earlier Wotan being the immortal sorcerer who could take out Dr. Fate, heavy hitter there. Black Adam, as you said, is pretty much Superman, but magical.
Right.
Some people may not know this, but in most versions of Superman, one of his weaknesses is magic.
Right.
So Black Adam having all of his strengths and coming from a power source that is essentially one of his two weaknesses, Black Adam is a powerhouse. And he wipes the floor with Superboy and Calder.
Right, right. Which I'm going to get into a little bit of this in our Canary debrief, too, talking about like how you do something like this and make it make sense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's one thing that you pointed out that I kind of caught when I was watching, but I just kind of filed it away and forgot, which was the swamp headquarters.
Ah, yes.
I'm giving that one to you.
The swamp headquarters is a great visual throwback to the Legion of Doom headquarters from the old Superman and Friends. Super Friends. Yeah.
Right.
Back in the old days of, meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice.
That was fantastic, by the way.
Which is here in Cincinnati, Ohio, by the way.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's right. The building they based it off of. That's right.
Yup. I've been there. I have pictures of it. When we went to visit it, I could not do anything but say, meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice for like an hour. That's all I could do.
Every time I go to jury duty, I can't help but just take a picture underneath the big sign that says Hall of Justice.
So yeah, that was a fun nod to those of us who either know through syndication and through general geek knowledge, or those of us like Rich who lived through that cartoon.
Yes, I lived through it for sure.
This episode had a lot happening beyond the action, though. It starts off with a little bit of exposition and a little bit of a reminder of all of the facts that have happened through the past 12 episodes.
Yeah.
Kind of an info dump, but it's not handled badly because it's basically just Batman laying out facts, and that's what Batman does. I'm okay with that.
And the team participating too, all kind of, you know, together, which is okay.
Yeah, and it's all these threads getting pulled together. But what's interesting is that we as viewers know this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that the Light is not the Injustice League. We don't know for certain, because at this point, if we're watching this for the first time, we've only seen the Light on the computer screens.
Right, and we only know, like, Lex and Ra's at this point. And maybe the Brain, but...
Right. I mean, the Brain was a giveaway. We knew the Brain from the computer screen. We confirmed Ra's and Lex in the previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
None of those three are among the group that we see on the computer screen of the Injustice League. So we as viewers know that something is wrong here.
Yep.
Which I think is a really interesting dynamic for the showrunners to do, because we're watching the show along with the characters. We're right there with Robin and Calder and McGann and Connor, everybody.
Right.
So we're with them saying, okay, oh, look, here's the bad guys. Here we go. Yeah. Wait a minute. That's not the same guy.
Yep.
So it makes this really cool dynamic of, we know something is happening in the meta plot before the characters do. So I think they did that on purpose to build our excitement level and to get us invested.
Yeah. And also, I just think they love these characters. And I think they chose to be like, okay, we're not going to use Black Adam as a cornerstone villain. We're not going to use Ultra Humanite. We're not going to, I mean, Wotan shows up 3 times, I think. So he's mentioned in the very first episode. He's going to be in another episode pretty soon. Just kind of as a bit of a background, but there. And this one, definitely gets front and center and finally gets some time to shine. And for people to even know who he is, right? So in the very first episode, the whole thing was Wotan is using the amulet of Aten to blot out the sun. That was the blot out the sun mission. This is the dude that was going to destroy the solar system. That's the level, power level we're talking about right now.
And beyond all of this, I think this episode really highlights the progression of the team.
Yeah. Good point.
We saw them training at the very beginning of this episode. We know they've been together for a while. One of the things that stood out to me, at one point, Calder and Artemis are fighting together, and they're without their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Artemis gets a fun little throwaway joke.
A little off-color joke, right.
Still funny for the character. I'm fine with that. And then Calder says, you know, we're just going to fight the way we've been training. Maneuver 7, go!
Right. The infamous Maneuver 7.
Which we will see multiple times.
Right. But we never see maneuvers 1 through 6 or 8 through anything else.
It's basically the Young Justice fastball special. Kidding around aside, we know that the team is working together. Through the first few episodes, we were building the team. We were figuring out who trusts who, how do we work together, what's going on. It was all that structuring, building the foundation. Not only is this episode their first major mission, but this is the first time we see them all cooperating in the field and doing it successfully.
Right. No, I agree. They do it against such big heavy hitters, too. They get nuked, but they're all working. This is the thing, though. You know what? I'm going to save it for the Canary debrief. But they're working at full capacity, and we never have any doubt that the team is working at full capacity at all times. They aren't a throwaway. They're holding their own.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been well established that these are the big guns.
And even though we are watching this team work at their cooperative capacity, the brilliance of Young Justice shines forth in that the animation style still supports each character's strengths.
Yeah.
We still see each character get his or her moment in the spotlight in fighting and tactics and dialogue. That does not go away. We don't lose what we've built in the past 12 episodes because it's a giant free-for-all brawl.
Right, exactly. I have to say there's one big thing that I didn't care for in this episode, which it was a bummer.
And I think you and I had the exact same thing in our notes, so...
Oh, really? This was not my favorite Joker. It's just not. I love Brent Spiner. I can never pronounce his name right. Sorry.
Hey, Brent, if you want to tell us how to pronounce your last name, come on the show.
Come on the show so we can talk about how we Didn't care for your interpretation of Joker? That doesn't sound good at all. It was oddly, they did a kind of Deadpool-y thing, particularly in the opening scene where he kind of broke the fourth wall and he's like, admit it, you can't take your eyes away. And everybody had the big stance and that kind of stuff. It just felt odd. And his dialogue was odd. And I don't know if it was the actual dialogue or the delivery, but they were just really long jokes that were pulling hard that didn't quite land. The multiple personalities joke, and it makes sense for Joker for sure, but the way that it was delivered or written, it just felt odd. I don't know why. I haven't been able to nail it. I just didn't like it that much.
I agree. I liked the character design.
I did too.
I liked how he looked on screen,
mm-hmm.
but there was just something about his personality that didn't mesh. And I've watched this episode a lot because I like when the two teams clash. I like when the league sweeps in and does cool things. So this is a top episode for me. And every time I watch it, I just cannot enjoy this version of the Joker.
I like that he went toe-to-toe with Robin. He did make that comment, I've always wanted to carve this bird, which I think is good. It's solid. It may give a little nod if they ever end up talking about, you know, some other Robins and their interactions with Joker. I guess we should just couch that in Crashing the Mode. But yeah, not my favorite. And you know what? I think James D'Amato and I talked about this too on an upcoming discussion session about characters like Riddler and Joker and these characters that usually get a lot more FaceTime than, say, Count Vertigo in all these DC productions. It's kind of okay that Joker isn't there. He gets plenty of airtime, you know, and it's okay that this wasn't the best Joker. It's a bummer, but it's okay with me because they really put a lot of emphasis in a lot of these supporting cast characters and giving them a lot of energy and pull in the show.
And speaking of giving that energy to a lot of characters, the Bioship was a really big character in this episode.
It was, and, you know, I mentioned before how much I love the Bioship. Just that little thing of the fact that Count Vertigo, with his really weird psychic power, affected the Bioship, and then through the Bioship affected McGann, but the Bioship was protecting everybody inside her. It just really gave that final, like, they've been hinting at it, but really gave this, like, no, this Bioship is a character, right? And I felt for her. Like, that's an impressive thing to pull off.
And it's not something that was overdone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like they decided, we need to make sure that this ship is recognized as a character and as something that is alive, and they hammered us with it in every episode.
Right.
They brought it up when it was needed, and they reinforced it when it was necessary. So yep. We all know it's important, but they didn't beat us over the head with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, cool. Well, I think we may need to move on to a Canary debrief.
Yeah, this is a pretty important point I want to make in storytelling for this one.
Stick around. Class is in session.
I've talked a lot about, in this particular series and across the board, about character agency, whether it's your novel or whether it's your role-playing game, of making sure that your characters are able to make the choices that need to be made and the choices aren't being made for them. And this is really important in Young Justice because you're dealing with all the sidekicks and you're still giving the Justice League a galaxy full of leaguers agency in the story, right? They're present in the story, and they're supporting cast, they're non-player characters from a role-playing term, but you can't let them make choices for you. If you're having Batman or Red Tornado giving them missions and living in the cave, you can't have Batman telling them everything that they need to do and why they need to do it and where they need to do it. It's nice that they give them that agency. So normally I would have some issues with the League coming in at the end of the episode to basically save the day, right? But they do some very subtle things in this that make this not an issue. One of them is defeating the villains was never part of the mission. The mission was stop the device, stop the plants. And once they stopped the plants, that freed the League to come and take care of the villains. So basically, stop the plants, distract the bad guys, don't die. That was their mission. And they completed their mission. And also the fact Calder had the helmet on meant that it was still a team member who, using a device the team had acquired to save everyone from a giant cloud of killing Joker gas. So you still have that. The team was not set aside, and thank goodness the League showed up to show us how it's done. That never happened. The League was there because they needed to be there, and it made sense. This also feeds into what we were talking about earlier about everybody working at full capacity in the team and still having it handed to them. I mean, you can't go toe-to-toe with that. You can't be Superboy and go toe-to-toe with Adam. You just can't. I mean, you can't be Aqualad alone going toe-to-toe with Wotan. It doesn't, from an internal consistency, both for the show and from DC Comics, it would have been really weird if somehow, unless they did it really well. I mean, taking out Joker, maybe. Count Vertigo, Artemis and Count Vertigo, perfect. That makes perfect sense, right? Teamwork, they took him down, that's fine. Ultra Humanite, not so much. They were allowed to push their limits and then have the League come in at the end to mop up. So focusing on what the mission was their goal, and it's what they did. And I think it's important to make sure that your supporting cast characters don't outshine your main players. This was a good example of how to walk that line, though. If you're having mentors, you're having more powerful characters in a D&D game, say in Forgotten Realms, and having Elminster or one of these major players come into your game to give advice and do things, you don't want Elminster saving the party, right? You want to find a way that he can support them, but make sure that your characters keep that agency.
And speaking of tabletop role-playing games, this is a great example of how to throw some more difficult villains at your party. Maybe villains that are too high a challenge rating or just way too difficult for your party members to deal with,
right,
into the mix to keep the game dangerous and exciting, but not have it be a fight that is completely unwinnable.
Right. Having non-combat alternative goals, and also making it very clear at the start of whatever the session is that you're doing that you will not be able to take these people down. You might take one down. You maybe take two down. There's six or seven people here, and it's going to be bad. So you're going to need to focus on staying alive long enough to get, say, two of your team members, Robin, McGann, to complete the goal of what needs to happen. So your alternative non-combat goals are keep everyone distracted and take care of the plants. And then that's it. But you make it clear to them they can't win this fight. Also, they can't really run away. Right? And that's a hard thing. If you put a really powerful villain into a standard game, there's kind of a social contract with a lot of tabletop role-playing games that anything we run into, we should be able to handle at our particular power level. Not always, depending on who your GM is, but usually you have to almost die in a fight to realize, oh, our GM DM is one of those GM DMs, and we could all die, so we need to plan better.
But I think what's important to take away from that is not every encounter needs to be a combat encounter.
Absolutely. And the same thing with increase in a novel, say, for example, increasing that the jeopardy level without just having more bad guys show up with bigger guns, right? It's the same thing.
Right. The worldwide threat was the focus.
Right. Exactly.
Yes, there was a group of six horribly powerful supervillains that were trying to punch you in the face, but you had to get through them. They were an obstacle to overcome. They weren't an obstacle to fight.
Yes, exactly. Good point.
That is something in tabletop games and in writing stories. Just because you have a villain on screen or on the game map, you don't have to fight that villain. That villain can be there to serve another purpose.
Right. And we're going to see that a lot in some upcoming episodes, Cold Hearted and some of these other episodes where even the villains are doing the same thing. Oh, I'm not here to defeat you. I'm just here to slow you down, or I'm here to distract you, or I'm here to do other things because they're smart and they're playing the long game. And mm-hmm. the heroes and your hero should do the same thing when it's appropriate for their characters. Yeah.
Yeah, so this episode has so many great examples of that, so that is definitely something to pay attention to in your own games and your own storytelling. Yeah, it's okay to utilize characters to do things other than have a fight.
Yeah. All right, let's crash some modes.
All righty, so let's get into crashing the mode.
Tell us something we don't know yet.
Sorry, BB. We can't risk altering the time stream. We do that, we're all feeling the mode.
We are going to be talking about spoilers here, specifically for this episode, but also for the rest of the Young Justice series, and some of DC in general. If you do not want to hear these spoilers, please stop listening and come back later. If you're still here, get ready.
Yeah. Fate.
Fate has such a great line in here. I almost wanted to use it for one of our intros when Joker at the end throws the gas at everybody.
Yeah.
First off, I love Batman just saying, "Don't breathe." Come on. Wait, Batman, who are you talking to? Not everyone is as good as you. Right. Give me a second. I just think that's hilarious.
Yeah.
And then Fate just fixing everything, basically just declaring Fate has intervened. I love it.
He has a lot of Fate puns. Yeah.
But it's okay. It's classic Silver Age, right?
It is. And somehow, like, things like that fold in so nicely and make sense. Because what's also interesting in that is that the entity in the helmet is not called Fate. His name is Naboo. So he's not really speaking to him about himself in third person, because he knows that Dr. Fate is an entity that is a name that's been given to him by the plane of existence he happens to be on. So it's this weird kind of subtle thing where you're like, okay, the third person speak is kind of weird and funny, but it's not really when you think about it. He's just making these, they're kind of puns, kind of not. Yeah, it just walks this really cool line. And then speaking of that, Aqualad too, I just realized we forgot in our recap to mention that Aqualad does get freed from the helmet. It's also one thing that's also a little bit of a deus ex machina for me. It made sense. They said Kent Nelson made a good argument. I would have liked to have heard that argument, but, you know, paying to have Ed Asner come back and do that kind of stuff was okay. It was okay with me, but it was something I had to kind of dismiss.
I really liked that we didn't hear it.
Oh, okay.
Because there was that pause at the end of the fight where Naboo is just standing there.
Yep.
And it's only a few seconds long, but it's got weight. Because we know that either we lose Calder or somehow Naboo gives up a body that has magical affinity. So yeah, we've got all this weight from the past few episodes where we've dealt with Dr. Fate before. And it's a panic moment.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
So I think not hearing that conversation and then just hearing at the end, oh yeah, Kent solved it. Yeah, it's a throwaway. It's a gimme, but it makes me as a viewer try to just play that out in my head, and it gets me into it a little bit more. So I love it. I love that moment where just nothing's happening and then Calder takes the helmet off, and I like the payoff that it was Kent again.
We're crashing the mode, right? Yeah, we're in the crashing the mode.
Yeah.
To back up your point, it also sets up the poignancy of the later reveal when somebody else puts the helmet on and KF says, "Kent would never let you do this. Take it off." And he says, "Kent Nelson did make a fervent argument."
And he's gone, and
he's dead now.
Oh.
So it's like, it does set up something for the long term. Within the context of the episode, though, I have to mention that it was something that I noted and had to go ahead and let go. But in the context of the bigger story, it really gives a punch to that later finality of who ends up with the helmet. So good.
This serves to make that moment worse and better.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. The other thing I wanted to mention was the Secret Society of Supervillains. They keep kind of, you know, our enemies have created a Secret Society of Supervillains. Not intending to name it that necessarily, because they called themselves the Injustice League. I'm assuming for kind of in story consistency, they're going to echo the Justice League. But the Secret Society of Supervillains was actually a reoccurring group of supervillains in DC Comics, and periodically led by the Ultra Humanite. I would have liked to see more Ultra Humanite. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Ultra Humanite. I don't know why. He was handled really well in the Justice League series. Particularly, there's a Christmas episode, I think, where he and Luther, like, break out of jail. And he's so great. He's just so upset that everybody won't shut up so he can listen to his opera music and that kind of thing. He can be handled as horrifying as an angry gorilla could be. But he's also, like, he's one step above Grodd in intellect and power. And he can be handled as a horrifying villain or as an entertaining villain. And I have a soft spot for him. And I'm glad that he's there. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of him.
Well, there's always a chance he will make a return. We do have season 3 to look forward to.
Yeah, and potentially 4 and 5. Actually, I did see a comment that Greg Weisman made that he's hoping for more seasons. Now, like with some really tightly written shows like Babylon 5 and other things, some of them went go on beyond when they should have. They had a story to tell. They told their story, but they were so popular because that story was told so well that they kept going. And I don't want that to happen to Young Justice. I want, if there's only 3 seasons and it's awesome, then great. I'm happy with that. If it's 4 or 5, that's fantastic. I don't want to go to 8 and have the last 3 seasons ruin the emotional memory of the first sets. That's my opinion.
Right, right. I agree. I think the other thing we wanted to point out here in our Crashing the Moat section was the light itself.
Yeah.
We finally get to see who the light is, and we can put some pieces together of who is working with whom, fill in the blanks from the past few episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that Vertigo is working with the light because of one of the opening statements that he makes in this episode, but also later we see he and Vandal Savage working together in Cold Hearted.
And speaking of Vandal Savage, he ends this episode with one of those great ominous lines that the shadows still conceal our light.
Yeah.
And it's a great supervillain line, but I think it also carries a little bit more weight. We know Ra's is there, so we could say that the light is working closely with the League of Shadows.
Right.
I also choose to, I think, recognize a little bit of a nod towards Cheshire and her storyline, because she's very much part of the Shadows.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of me reading into it a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I think that it really is telling us that there is so much more than what is happening right now in this first season.
Yeah.
Because in the scope of season 2, we know that the light has been working with what will eventually happen in season 2 for some time.
Yeah.
So I think this moment is the writer telling the listener or the viewer, yeah, there's a supervillain plot happening, but there's another level and it is still hidden from us. So stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Cool, cool. Anything else we want to crash here before we move on?
I think I'm good. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's move on to fan service. Rich, please wrap up our episode here with some fun fan service.
Yeah, no problem. So if you listen to our 2017 New Year announcement, you have heard us talk about the DC Comics Squadcast. The DC Comics Squadcast is part of the Suicide Squadcast Network. And the DC Comics Squadcast specifically basically does what we do with Young Justice, except that they do it with the new DC Comics Rebirth, which is good for me personally. I read Rebirth 1 at the time of this recording. It was fantastic. I've read the first 3 issues of both Aquaman and Nightwing on Comixology. They were fantastic as well. I can't afford to, nor do I have the time to cover to read every single thing that's going on in DC across the board. And as much as I would love to give them money for doing a good job, I really want to know what's happening across the board and then be able to purchase my own comics, the specific ones that I really want to support, without feeling like I'm missing out. Not only do they talk about just what's happening in Rebirth, they talk about the history behind all of the things that are leading in. For example, in DC Comics Rebirth, they have some characters that haven't been around in a really long time, and they're making echoes to old Justice Society characters that haven't been around in DC 52. So you're getting nods to, like, for those of us who grew up reading on these comics, we're getting that emotional connection to Rebirth in a way that I haven't gotten in a while, which I really, really like. And they dive into that, just like we talk about, say, the history of Blue Devil, like in this episode. They talk a little bit about, you know, Johnny Thunder or all these characters that are in the background that you may not know because it's been a while since they've been in the main comics. It's a great podcast. The sound quality is fantastic. I haven't listened to the other Suicide Squadcast Network shows yet, but I have, from when I mentioned it online, people jumped on and said they're all great. They cover the TV shows, they cover the movie universes, and now the comics as well. So go by and check them out. They're a really cool group of people.
And the links for that will be in the show notes and on the website, crashingthemode.com as well. So please swing on over, give them a listen, and check them out. Also on our website, we have resource pages with art, links to all the fan service we've talked about, the AMVs, the songs we've discussed. Please continue to check out the website and look at all of that stuff as we move further into 2017. There will be more and more information there to peruse and enjoy. And if you, listener out there, are a creator of content for Young Justice or anything DC, please get a hold of us. We would love to be in touch with you, maybe to feature you as a guest for a discussion episode, maybe simply to feature you here in our fan service section. So please reach out to us via the website, Facebook, email, Twitter, smoke signals, a giant spotlight shining into the night sky above
Boom Tube,
Zeta Tube, whatever you want to do. Just get a hold of us. We'll have a chit chat. We'll have a great time. And with all of that being said, I believe it is time to wrap up this mission and head out of the cave. Thank you so much for listening. We absolutely appreciate you giving us about an hour of your time today. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And don't forget to feel the Aster.
And keep using hashtag keep binging YJ on Netflix to get those numbers doing well. We still don't know where season 3 is going to be released, so I don't know. We'll see. And also, the hashtag for Young Justice Season 3 that I've seen floating around is hashtag YJ3. Keeps it short, keeps it simple, and lets you write more in your 140 characters. And finally, as always, everyone, stay whelmed.
You've been listening to Whelmed, the Young Justice Files podcast. Our computer is voiced by Madison Ray. Our theme was composed by Emily Mio. Our logo was created by Kevin Bates. Whelmed is a fan-made podcast and is not officially affiliated with DC Comics, DC Entertainment, Warner Brothers Animation, and any other owners of Young Justice or its related source material. As such, these companies have sole ownership of all symbols, images, names, logos, and proprietary material related to Young Justice. Original content of this podcast is ours under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening, and stay whelmed.